The next case was presented by Dr. Mike Dixon, a breast surgeon in the UK who's taken a leadership role in research evaluating neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, as exemplified by the patient he presented.
This is a 74-year-old woman, and she's quite interesting because she did a lot of ballroom dancing. So eventually she came along because the cancer was stopping her dancing because it was leaking. And dancing was a big part of her life, and she didn't come along because the cancer was kind of, she realized it would interfere with the things she wanted to do. And we do see a few older patients who are aware that they've got a cancer, but hide it for some time, and eventually they can't manage it anymore. And so this is the lady here, the 74-year-old. It's ulcerated. The core biopsy shows grade 2 invasive cancer. It's ER and PR positive, HER2 negative. The cancer's mobile, but it's ulcerated. You could excise it, but you'd have to do a mastectomy, which she doesn't want because it's going to interfere with her dancing.
What's her comorbidities in general health?
This woman's a pretty fit woman, and you know, she also, like I think many of us, pretty vain, and she wasn't at all keen to have the surgeon hack her about, if you like, and make her less good looking. I think that's what she thought.
You know, that phenomenon of people who present with locally advanced disease and seem to have ignored it, and I think you see that in all ages, is very interesting. Had she gotten routine medical care? Did she take care of herself? Is she responsible?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, very sensible, otherwise fit, not on a lot of medication, and yeah, she looked really good for her years.
What was her emotional reaction when she found out this was breast cancer? She already knew it.
Yeah, she knew it, and a lot of these patients know it, and they delay coming because they don't want the consequences of the diagnosis. And one of the consequences of the diagnosis in many of these women, they think they're going to lose the breast. So that's actually what stops them coming along.
We asked Mike to review this field, not just the issue of locally advanced disease, but the issue of neoadjuvant endocrine therapy in general, which has been utilized a lot more in Europe than it is in the United States. Mike?
If you look at aromatase inhibitors and conversion to breast-conserving surgery, the good news is that whether you use letrozole, anastrozole, or exemestane, all three drugs have been shown to be superior to tamoxifen in their rate of conversion from mastectomy to breast-conserving surgery. So we have three good drugs that are effective and more effective than our standard treatment, tamoxifen. There is one study, very small study, which has compared neoadjuvant endocrine and chemotherapy. 121 postmenopause women, very small study by Semiglasov. These women were ER and or PR positive, randomized to chemotherapy or hormone therapy. The chemo was pretty good chemo. It was adriamycin and paclitaxel 3 weekly, and the endocrine therapy was anastrozole. Both the groups got 3 months of treatment. What they found was that the response rates, clinical and mammographic, were pretty similar in these women, whether they got chemotherapy, anastrozole, or exemestane, and even the path CR rates in this group were not actually significantly different. Interestingly, the rate of breast-conserving surgery were actually higher with the anastrozole and exemestane than with the chemotherapy. They weren't quite significantly higher, but there's a reason why I believe they might be higher, and we'll come to that. The local recurrence rate was similar after both agents. And what we've shown is that if you actually treat patients for longer than 3 months, what you find is in the first 3 months, you get a 50% reduction, mean reduction in volume. And then if you look at the volume at 3 months, so look between 3 and 6 months, you get another 50% shrinkage. And from 9 to 12 months, you get another 50% shrinkage from where it was, so it's shrinking all the time. And even out to 2 years, you still get overall continued volume reduction. So you can actually use endocrine therapy for longer to gain that kind of response. And this is her after surgery, and she's back dancing. And this is a pathology. There is this central scar in the middle of the cancer. And this is something you see frequently with neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, and you rarely see this with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. The cancer implodes, it pulls in from the center, and that's why you're more successful in your breast conserving surgery. The problem with neoadjuvant chemotherapy is you get different patterns. Often you can classify the patterns in tumour as diffuse, nodular, scattered, or path CR. And if you actually look at the rate of diffuse, nodular, scattered, and path CR patterns after neoadjuvant endocrine therapy and neoadjuvant chemotherapy, they differ. So although when we start with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, in this case it was letrozole that we looked at, the same is actually true for anastrozole. We had diffuse patterns and nodular patterns only. Afterwards, diffuse patterns were more common after chemo. Nodular patterns the same, but these scattered foci, more common after chemo. Central scar, much more common after letrozole. And complete response, pathologic response, more frequent. But it's these scattered foci that make breast conserving surgery so difficult and are so frustrating for the surgeon who goes in to take out what the oncologist says is a complete clinical response, only to find that the pathologist shows that he's failed and we've taken the cancer, what we think the cancer out, but it goes to all the edges.
Tabu, what are your thoughts about the issue of neoadjuvant endocrine therapy? It's not used very much in this country, maybe not such an extreme case as this. Younger patient, maybe around 60, doesn't have locally advanced disease, but has a tumor that's too big to do breast conserving surgery. She wants breast conserving surgery. We know in this country, this lady's most likely to get chemotherapy. Is that really rational based on the kinds of data that Mike's talking about?
Well, I think the landscape is changing quite a bit in terms of people's attitudes. We are learning more about adjuvant, neoadjuvant endocrine therapy. We have been fixed on the PCR rate for a very long time because the chemotherapy studies have shown us that for a given regimen, PCR rate translates into a better long-term outcome. However, this does not reconcile with the fact that PCR rates are lower with endocrine therapy, yet the long-term outcome is generally better in patients with hormone-responsive therapy. So the information about the patterns of response we've known from MRI for some time, but this is really the first time I've seen these differential responses that may even facilitate breast-conserving surgery. But there's no doubt that you improve the odds of breast-conserving surgery with either neoadjuvant chemo or hormonal therapy. One might argue whether hormonal therapy is better. But I think that it's an underutilized tool. And of course, keep in mind that the use of chemotherapy after surgery is always an option. The other thing that I wonder, and this has not been proven one way or the other, but let's say you have a patient that is in their mid, upper 70s, and you're not even sure that you're going to use chemotherapy at all. I think that the response to neoadjuvant therapy may help you make that decision. Someone who has a really good response to neoadjuvant hormonal therapy perhaps can just get away with surgery and radiation without any chemo, whereas the person who does not respond at all, maybe that person would get more out of chemotherapy, and that may help make a more rational decision.
In addition to the issue of efficacy is also the issue of toxicity. Aman, where are we right now in understanding differential toxicity of the three AIs? And particularly, can you update us a little bit on the issue of cardiovascular events, which we heard about, you know, about a year or so ago? Where are we right now with that?
I think if we look at the overall efficacy of three aromatase inhibitors, in the same type of settings, they show similar overall efficacy. That proportional reduction is very similar. Like if you look at the ATAC versus the big 98, the similar follow-up, there is a proportional reduction which is very similar. As far as the major side effects of aromatase inhibitors, which are arthralgias, myalgias, osteoporosis, increased risk of fracture, between the three AIs, the risk is identical between the three AIs. Only thing which is slightly of concern is that numerically there may be slightly higher cardiovascular events with the letrozole and exemestane in the shorter follow-up and cardiovascular deaths with these two aromatase inhibitors compared to the anastrozole. Question is it because these populations are different in different parts of the globe, these patients were accrued, or is it real? And I think only way we can say is that additional studies are needed, and there are a couple of studies which are going to compare head-on these aromatase inhibitors, and that will provide better safety profile. But I think right now, as a physician, and we need to share this information which is available with our patient when we decide what is the best way to treat these patients.
Mike, what do we know about quality of life when the three aromatase inhibitors? Aman talked about the arthralgias, which is certainly one of the major considerations. What do we know about differential effects and switching from one to another?
Yeah, I mean, we presented some data here looking at quality of life. Surprisingly, global quality of life in women who weren't getting chemotherapy, who got adjuvant AIs, actually improved. So they are pretty well tolerated drugs. Yes, there were a number of side effects, but there were identical side effects whether you took anastrozole or letrozole. One of the interesting things that didn't come out in the poster is that if you get side effects on one drug, you don't always get the same side effects on another drug. So that does suggest if the patient can't tolerate letrozole, switch to anastrozole. If they can't tolerate anastrozole, you might try letrozole. So I think that's quite interesting.
Just to briefly ask John if you can comment on this question of side effects of the AIs. And in your experience, we don't really have any clinical research data. Do you have patients who go from one to the other and get better?
Well, I think that anytime you have a patient with a symptom and you make a change, be it change their drug or ask them to turn around three times, you've got a placebo effect. And oftentimes people present to you when the things are most extreme. And there's a statistical phenomenon called regression to the mean, which basically means that if you do something, chances are the extreme situation will revert. So the fact is, in my experience, you can change these patients and they'll often feel better. And I'm not entirely certain whether this is placebo effect, regression to the mean, or whether there actually are true differences among the drugs. In my experience, and it's limited, I would have suggested that I see more difference in side effects if I go from a non-steroidal to a steroidal AI, or the other way around, than if I switch from anastrozole to letrozole. So my experience has been when someone has a symptom on one class, I switch them to the other.
Do you find that specifically with the arthralgias that they tend to get better over time, and could that be explaining it? You're switching it, but somehow the tissue's getting used to the lower estrogen levels?
Well, I think that women in general are tougher than men, and they gradually get used to problems.
I'm tempted to put up an agree-disagree in between, but I think we'll skip it. I think we might have a prejudiced group here.